This episode deals with drug and alcohol abuse. If you or someone you know is dealing with alcohol or substance abuse issues, please reach out for help. There are plenty of sources near you that you can find online to get help from a professional. Now, just over 3 months into my investigation into the murder of Rhonda Sue Coleman, I found myself already overwhelmed with a continually growing list of suspicious characters, theories, and stories. And my list of questions is only getting longer. I've pored through old newspapers, news footage on VHS tapes, and my desk is littered with post-it notes containing names, dates, phone numbers, and questions scribbled down. Everyone in Hazelhurst, it seems, has an opinion as to who is really responsible. And all I can do at this point is take note of everything I hear and try to see how that could all fit together with the facts we actually have. A loose timeline of events on the night of her abduction, various recollections from the location Rhonda's body was found, and an eyewitness account of the speeding truck and a cry for help heard by the group of fox hunters. After speaking with Zach Marchett, the nephew of one of the fox hunters, who were likely the last people to see or hear Rhonda Coleman alive, my focus had now turned to a name I'd heard around town as a person who could also possibly be involved in some way with Rhonda's abduction or murder. And once again, I want to remind you that I'm simply reporting on the things I'm hearing through my conversations with people close to Rhonda or who were involved in the initial investigation some 30 years ago. In no way is this podcast meant to cast guilt or responsibility on anyone for her death at this point. And though we'll all come to eventually make our own conclusions, I ask that you please refrain from doing so until you've heard the whole story. But Mickey's name came up more than once, so I decided to circle back on him and find out why he had fingers pointed in his direction in the first place. I spoke with several of Rhonda's classmates who knew Mickey well.
For whatever reason, he got the nickname in high school, Mookie Bleacher. I don't know where it came from. Don't ask me why. But he always, he was just like the goofy, funny guy. Like, he's never said anything out of the way to me. He never, he was the one that cracked jokes. But I do know that about the time we graduated is when the rumors started that he had started to get into drugs, and from everything I had heard, it was more than just marijuana. He was the class clown. He was the funny, you know what I mean? He was the one who always was laughing and cutting up and joking, and we had all seen the change in him.
When I asked Tracy about Mickey, it didn't take her long to get to the fact that he had begun to develop a drug and alcohol problem his senior year of high school. If you ask around Hazelhurst about Mickey, it's one of the things that comes up almost every time, but not in a what a disgusting drug addict kind of way, more like what a shame he went down that path. On the night of May 17th, 1990, Tracy Slater, Curtis Harper, and Michelle Anthony were at the party at Mickey's house.
It was a typical senior party, but yeah, there was people drinking, but I would not say that there was anybody there that night that just overly stood out that was drunk. I don't remember anybody standing out. I do remember, and I know that has been a name that's been brought up several times, is that Mickey Beecher had left. I do remember that part, and I do remember him coming back. Some people have said something about him being with somebody, and that when he came back, that I don't remember. I can't say that there was or wasn't somebody with him when he came back. I don't remember that part. I do remember them having the police light that everybody talks about. I do remember that part. Now, I won't even say that they were gone that long, because we all weren't there. It wasn't like it was a six-hour party. It was a school night.
The police light that Tracy mentioned was one of those blue lights that cops reach out of the car window and stick on the roof before going on some high-speed chase. At least, that's how it happens in the movies. Mickey's father had previously been a cop, and that's where he got this blue light from. He and a few of the other guys were driving around that night and using the light to pull people over as a prank.
Being stupid teenagers, as far as I knew, I don't know what they did with it. When they left, they had it at the house and they were using it. And then, I know he left and I know he came back. But We didn't leave. We were all still there then.
Where the house we was at, Mickey Beecher's house, his daddy was an ex-deputy sheriff. Okay? He had a blue light in his barn that we were in. And some of the guys took that blue light and put it on their car and started chasing cars around out there on the Broxton Highway close to where Mickey lives. I say chasing car around. He had the blue light on top of his car. They were running up and down the highway.
Remember that both law enforcement and the Colemans believe that Rhonda wouldn't have pulled over that night unless she knew the person, or it was the police pulling her over. Could it have been Mickey or one of his friends using his blue police light to pull Rhonda over?
I do know that that night it got broken well before any time Rhonda would have went missing. I actually was standing there when it broke. They were messing around with it, and I don't even remember who it was, but they dropped it and it broke. Unless they were able to put it back together, and the lens broke, and I don't know if the light was still working, but the lens had broke.
Several people did see Mickey leave the party, though no one knows who he was with or who, if anyone, was with him when he returned. Michelle Anthony said that she witnessed the light being dropped and broken at some point that night, but she can't confirm whether it still worked or not. And when Mickey left the party, Rhonda was still there. Could that light have been used again later that night to pull Rhonda over if it did still work? If not by Mickey, possibly by one of his friends.
For a long time, I really did think that it was more about Mickey and John, because Mickey and John were friends. And I thought that it was probably more John got in over his head, Mickey helped.
No one I spoke to said that they saw John at the party that night. And then Michelle Anthony shared something else with me.
I left the house a little early, and I was driving in my dad's little cargo van and was heading over towards Mickey's to see if anybody was there yet, and cut through, and the names of the roads have left me, but I cut through one of the roads to get over to the road that Mickey's house was on. As I was driving down the road, I saw this pickup truck sitting in the field to the right. And it had plenty of time to pull out. It looked like it was about to pull out. And I guess I was probably a couple miles away and could see the headlights and such. And so I wasn't going, I was going the speed limit. And as I got closer, he kind of edged up a little bit like he was going to pull out in front of me, and then he didn't. When I went by, I could see that it was two men in the vehicle. One had dark-colored hair and a mustache, and one had light-colored hair. It was a dark-colored truck, and probably like a Silverado size. I went past them. I was still going the speed limit, and they pulled out so quickly, it kind of scared me. I sped up, and they sped up. I go even faster, and they went even faster. It was almost like they were waiting on me or waiting on somebody, and was just, I guess, giving me a hard time. As a girl driving along, seeing something like that just kind of looked unsettling. So I get to the end of the road, and they were just right up on the back of the vehicle. So I went ahead, made my right-hand turn to head towards where Mickey's house was. They followed me. They were right on my butt. And as soon as I turned left and immediately flung the vehicle into Mickey's yard, they slowed down going by, I think that's Broxton Highway. And they went really, really, really slow, like they were watching to see what I was going to do. And then they sped off. I was kind of shaken, so I went up to the Walmart there in town and saw one of my fellow classmates and told him what happened. I went back and didn't think anything about it at that point in time. I went back to Mickey's house, and we hung out and all that stuff. And then to find out the next morning at school that she was gone.
Two men in a dark-colored truck. Remember what the group of fox hunters reported witnessing? A dark-colored truck speeding past them and a woman crying for help. Could this have been the same truck? And at least now, we have some description of the two men. There's more to this story, and we'll come back to it. But for now, I want to concentrate on Mickey. I spoke with John Lee, who was a patrol officer with the Hazelhurst City Police in 1990.
I had an opportunity to go to the sheriff's office. So, you know, eventually, several years after the fact, I quit the police department, went to the sheriff's office. And I worked there patrol for several years. And then I went to the investigations division. And so that's where I got my first contact with it, really. Mickey, he injected himself into a lot of the news camera and stuff like that. He tried to interject himself in the investigation.
John's referring to interviews and statements Mickey made like this from Rhonda's funeral.
We didn't want to do it, but for her sake, we'll do anything, you know, to catch the fella.
You know, his daddy was law enforcement, of course. And, I always thought Mickey had something to do with it because I kept looking at him, and more so than anybody else. I didn't like Mickey. Mickey was a piece of trash, to be honest with you. His lifestyle really was sucky, and he got away with a lot of things coming up because his daddy was a deputy sheriff at the time. But we have nothing. And of course, when he died, I was already away from that investigation altogether. You know, there's a lot of issues there that are questionable about that night, and Mickey being one of them that still rings out in my head.
I had hoped to talk to Mickey, but unfortunately, an aneurysm took his life in 2018 at the age of 48. But I did speak to his mother, Emily, who spoke candidly about her only child. She instantly tears up when pointing to his picture on the wall.
So that's his daughter there in the picture with him, and same one there with me. That's my husband right here, and they're by the truck. And she's got a little boy, 11 years old. So that's all I have is her and my little great-grandson. So. It's kind of rough by itself.
Emily is a Georgia peach, the real deal. She's sweet and soft-spoken, but I immediately sense an underlying sadness in her eyes and in her voice when we sit down at her kitchen table to talk on a sunny Sunday afternoon. Her husband passed away in 2005, then Mickey just a few years ago. I get the feeling that she was happy to invite me in to talk, partly just to have some company.
He was a big old cut-up. He was just a big old teddy bear. He loved everybody and everything. He loved life. He loved having a good time.
Emily paints a vastly different picture of Mickey than some other people I've spoken to. They were very close, and they were friends as much as mother and son. But I wanted to know how Mickey felt about Rhonda and being accused of her murder.
Well, Mickey would get upset every time he talked about it. He'd just cry. He said, "Mama, I loved Rhonda like a sister. I wouldn't have done anything to her." But the tale got out that he had done it. He had done it, and that wasn't so. As a matter of fact, the tale got out one time at when I was working at the bank. One of our customers came in and told some of the girls in there that they had arrested him. There was probably 10 or 15 of us that worked there. And every once in a while, I'd look up and I'd see two or three girls standing there talking, you know, somewhere else in the bank. Later, I'd see two or three more. And every time I'd walk up, they'd quit talking. And I said, "I want to know what's going on. I know y'all must be talking about me or something." And one of them finally said, "Well, we heard that Mickey had been arrested, that they had him in jail." I said, "That's not so." I picked up my phone, called my husband. They were at the house for some reason. He said, "No, Mickey's right here with me. He's not in jail." And see, that was just a bald-faced lie.
This is a perfect example of how things get stirred up in a small town. And what some people don't realize is how much an exaggerated or manufactured story or rumor can hurt the people involved. Because innocent or not, the stigma never goes away.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
Judge's decision was based on finding there is a
likelihood. So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
For Emily, one of the hardest things to stomach is hearing this and knowing that Rhonda and Mickey were close friends, and Mickey cared for her deeply. Though she says he loved her, he wasn't in love with her. I asked if her and Mickey had ever discussed who he thought killed Rhonda.
He never told me who he thought it was.
I mean, but so you guys never had that conversation? Do you think that's odd?
He always told me he didn't know.
Yeah.
I mean, when we talked about it, he said, I don't know, Mama.
Yeah.
I wasn't there. I didn't do it, and I don't know who did do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess that's the reason they kept questioning him so. I guess they thought that he was close enough to her or to them. Or I know they really was on his case at different times because, you know, that got out that he was arrested, and he wasn't arrested.
Mickey was taken in for questioning several times, and he took a polygraph and passed. Even years after, when John Lee started his investigation, he looked into Mickey, but it led nowhere. But it was too late. The damage had already been done to Mickey's reputation around town.
Over the years, as a matter of fact, he started dating a girl, and actually, they were with another couple, and something was brought up about the murder of Rhonda. The man said something, yeah, Mickey, they accused you of killing her, didn't they? And he said that girl just got so upset that he was with. He said, Mama, I didn't kill that girl. But he said, that's just the way it is. Every time I go somewhere or do something, people's accusing me of it. And I imagine that's the reason he felt so uncomfortable. I don't know. He said, Mama, I can't go anywhere without somebody saying something. I mean, it kind of tapered off the last few years, but it was rough now for all of us. I think it was because of the fact that so much took place out here. And they felt like because they were out here that he knew what she was doing.
How much did Emily know about what happened at the party that night? After all, it was in the barn behind her house.
They came out here, I think, because that big barn out there, and they had room to do whatever they wanted to do, and that's the reason they wanted to go out there. So they'd have plenty of room, and they had electricity, and they could kind of be out there by themselves, but yet we were right here, you know. The kids had been out here every night working. Oh, they had the music going out there. They was really having a good time, you know.
Emily tells me that the party actually went on for several nights, starting on Monday of that week.
I had to go to the hospital the week that happened. They were here. They started on Monday night. I said it was Monday night and Tuesday night. I had to go to Macon to the hospital. And I didn't come back till Friday. And that was the first thing we heard when we got home Friday afternoon. This friend of ours stopped by, and she said, I guess y'all have heard about Rhonda. We said, what? What are you talking about? No, we just got home. She said, oh, Rhonda went missing after the kids got through out here at the barn making their banners and all. And so when we got home, that's what we heard. And we couldn't get a hold of Mickey. Wilton and I jumped in the car to go see if we can find them. She said they were out looking for her then. And he had, I don't know whose horse he was on, but he was off on the horse, helping to look for her. And he was just so torn up and broken about it. And, you know, we just couldn't imagine. And then we heard on Sunday that they had found her body. And anyway, it was just heartbreaking to hear everything that had happened.
The hospital in Macon is about an hour and a half drive from Hazelhurst, so Emily could provide no information about what took place in the barn on Thursday night. But I was able to speak with another friend of both Rhonda's and Mickey's named Brent Haynes. He preferred for our conversation to not be recorded. Brent was actually dating Rhonda at the time, though the two had only been together for a few weeks. He was initially brought in for questioning by the GBI, but they quickly determined that he was not a viable suspect. Brent told me things were good between he and Rhonda, and that her circle of friends were not necessarily the same as his. It was a little tough to get Brent to speak at first because it seems he feels the case will unfortunately probably never be solved. In his eyes, too much time has passed. He said that continuing to question people about Rhonda's death feels a little like beating a dead horse. He told me that there was no drama of any kind that he can remember at Mickey's party. Everyone was having a good time. He and Rhonda rode together from the party back to pick up her car at the Swanee Swifty convenience store. When he last saw Rhonda, she got into her car and drove away. After thinking for a minute, he said looking back, he wishes he would have followed Rhonda to make sure she got home safely. Later that night, and shortly after it was realized that Rhonda was missing, he and Mickey drove around together looking for her until approximately 2 a.m. or so. He told me that Mickey was upset and worried, and his emotions seemed to be authentic and genuine. He remembered some people messing around with the police light, and he did also mention that he saw a change in Mickey once drugs and alcohol came into the picture. When I asked Emily Beecher about the police light, though, she said she never even heard anything about it until now. But I questioned her about Mickey's drug and alcohol issues. This, however, was something she did know about.
Mickey did have some problems with drugs. When kids first get into that, you don't notice it. But now later on in years, when he had been messed up, I could tell sometimes. But when he was in high school, I didn't know if he was now. I think he did some. I don't know if it got. I didn't realize it was going on. If it was, anyway. Right. Or either he avoided coming home or, sure. You know, till he got straightened out some. I don't know.
According to Emily, later in life, Mickey had injured his back and required several surgeries. He was in a lot of pain and maybe abused the painkillers he was prescribed or used other drugs or alcohol to numb the pain. He also struggled with the loss of his father in 2005. She tells me that Mickey was interviewed a number of times by police and the GBI. But as far as she knows, he was not considered an official suspect.
I wasn't in the presence when they did it, but I know they've been here two or three times and talked to him. And I know one time when he was working out of town and they went down there to the motel.
Emily stands by the belief that her son is innocent, no matter how checkered his past may be.
I just don't believe it was Mickey.
No.
I do not believe it was Mickey. Listen, I don't care how old they get. They're still your child. And you still love them. And you're still going to be mom and daddy. I don't care if you're 100 and they're 80.
Before I leave Emily's home, she does tell me one more thing that she seemed to have nearly forgotten until we started discussing Rhonda's murder in depth.
And you know, 1 year to the day after Rhonda got killed, Mickey got a letter written on a piece of paper towel or something. you know who done that to Rhonda and all this kind of stuff. And me and Wilton, we carried it to the sheriff. And I don't know what they did with it.
Though the person who wrote the cryptic letter didn't sign their name, Emily recognized the handwriting.
When I worked at the bank, John worked at Napa Auto Parts. And John was stealing from Napa Auto Parts. Now, I know this because my cousin was the manager of the store down there. And I didn't think they were supposed to get checks cash because my cousin had told me. And one day, John came in there and he got a bunch of checks cashed. He just stamped them on the back, you know, and got them cashed. And I didn't say anything about it to anybody else. But when I saw Dale, my cousin, I said, "Dale, is John supposed to be cashing checks for the store?" He said, "No." I said, "Well, you better put an eye on him." So Dale set a trap for him, and he caught him, and he got fired. And I knew from his handwriting, I knew his handwriting because I had seen it. He didn't sign his name, but I know that was his writing.
If this letter still exists in a police evidence file somewhere, is it possible to compare the handwriting to John's to see if it does match? If it does, what would that prove? I've reached out to the Jeff Davis County Sheriff, Preston Bohannon, but he seems to not want to take my calls, or return my calls, or see me when I stop by. But I'm starting to wonder, do all roads really lead to John?
John was going with one of the twins.
The twins Emily mentioned were Rhonda's best friends. And one of them, Treese, was dating John at the time of Rhonda's murder.
Mickey was spending a lot of time over there with Treese and Trina and Rhonda and all that. And I actually think John was jealous of Mickey because he got along with him so good. He was one by himself, you know, and didn't have anybody, so he had a good time of it. Because Mickey could walk up and talk to anybody. He'd made friends with everybody, I mean. But I think that was the biggest thing wrong with John was the fact that he was jealous.
John's alleged jealous personality is again called into question. I've heard from numerous people that John took issue with anyone who occupied his girlfriend's time other than him. Male or female. I wonder now, how does all this tie together with what Michelle Anthony told me about the dark-colored truck following her to Mickey's house that Thursday night?
I had an instance where, I think it was that Monday, we were at the GBI office, and I was standing outside with some of the other classmates, and we were talking, and this man walked up. And again, I didn't run in Rhonda's crowd. I didn't, so I had no idea who this person was. And take it with a grain of salt if you want to, but this guy, I mean, he literally gave me the heebie-jeebies. When I saw his face, it reminded me of the guy that I saw in the truck that night. I think he just walked up and was talking, you know, said hey to the other people I was standing with. I think he walked off and went inside to be questioned, and I said, "Who was that?" And they said that was John, Teresa's boyfriend. I know it sounds weird, but I get feelings about people, and they're usually right. But he just, when I saw his face, I felt like that was the face of one of the people in the truck that night.
Michelle saw the faces of the two men in the truck that followed her when they slowed down and crept by after she pulled onto Mickey's property.
And I'm not at 100% sure at this point, but I think the other guy was somebody that used to work at Triple H, which is where my mother worked at the time. And this guy would have worked in the warehouse. I didn't know who they were, but I worked there at Triple H during the summer, and I saw this guy, the dark-haired guy. And again, I can't say 100% that this was the guy, but he looked very much like the guy that was in the truck, the other guy. I can tell you that the dark-headed guy looked much older than the blonde, and he had a mustache, and he was kind of gaunt looking. cheeks were a little sunken in. I mean, it's just, I don't know. It just has been in my head for 30 years. It scared the daylights out of me.
The mystery surrounding Michelle's encounter poses some very big unanswered questions. Who were the two people in the truck? What did they want? Why did they follow her and drive by slowly when she pulled onto the Beecher's property? Could these two men be involved in some way with Rhonda's murder just a few hours later? And how does Mickey play into all this, other than the fact that the party was at his house? From what I've heard so far, he was a good friend of Rhonda's who was devastated when she was killed. He helped search for her with Rhonda's then-boyfriend. He was seen shortly after she was reported missing, hanging out at the Hardee's in downtown Hazelhurst with some other classmates. So how could he have been seen in all these different places and had time to kill Rhonda, drive 15 miles away to dispose of her body, drive 15 miles back, and have been calm and collected enough to not have arose any suspicion from the people he spoke to? It just doesn't seem to fit together. But shortly before finishing this episode, I was put in touch with a woman who had an entirely different story altogether.
I know Mickey Beecher was one that was harassing her.
Did Mickey have, like, a crush on her?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
But she didn't, she wasn't with that with Mickey. She didn't want to go that with Mickey. He was in the drugs. He was doing the dealings with Jerry.
That's Alexis Chambers. She was a friend of Rhonda's, and she's actually the sister of the woman who I met on my first trip to Hazelhurst, the one who affectionately called Milton and Gail Mama and Daddy. Alexis saying that Mickey had a crush on Rhonda definitely falls more into line with what I've heard from others, despite what Emily told me. This is important because, of course, jealousy or lust can become a motive for murder. Alexis says that not only was Mickey using drugs at the time, but he was also involved in dealing them, along with another man named Jerry. She goes on to tell me that a family friend of hers witnessed something odd on the night of Rhonda's disappearance.
Her name was Emma Slay. She stayed at Edgewood Villa, the projects over there.
Emma Slade worked the early morning shift at a small diner called Corson's Country Kitchen. As she got ready for her work shift in the early morning hours on Friday, she spotted her neighbor, Jerry, and another man.
He lived in a house across the street. I think it was maybe like 4 o'clock that morning. She was getting up, getting ready to go to work. She was sitting on her porch smoking a cigarette, and she seen them put something in a bag in the back of Jerry's truck. And him and Mickey Beecher got in the truck, and she said they was going fast, going towards Uvalde Highway. She said they was going real fast.
I asked if Emma Slade could be absolutely positive that these were the two men she saw that night.
Yes, she was absolutely positive. She knew them because they came in the Corson's kitchen a lot. It was 2 days later when Mickey and Jerry came in to eat. From what Emma told us, she seen the scratches on Mickey and on Jerry.
Emma Slade passed away several years ago. So once again, a possible connection has taken their story to the grave. The problem I've run into is the same that law enforcement has for 30 years. There is an abundance of circumstantial evidence, but nothing tangible. No hard evidence yet to connect anyone to Rhonda's murder. But I'm not done digging yet. Fox Hunter is a production of Imperative Entertainment. It was created, written, and reported by me, Sean Kipe, and I wrote the original music score. Executive producers are Jason Hoke and Gino Falsetto. Story editor is Jason Hoke. Sound engineering by Shane Freeman. Key cover art provided by Joe Freeman Jr., Keychalis 9032, 2015. JoeFreemanJr.com. Fox Hunter is a 10-episode series available every Tuesday morning. Follow us on social media at Fox Hunter Podcast. If you like the show, leave us a review and tell your friends. Thanks for listening.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.